Hello, my name's Laura Adams and I'm a guide for London Walks and I'm a Blue Badge guide. Today I'm going to talk about a terrible catastrophe that occurred on the 2nd of September 1666, the Great Fire of London. Now this is a fire that burnt for 4 days and four nights and in which 80% of our city was lost. We lost over 13,000 houses, 87 churches, 44 livery halls. It was a fire which the great diarist Samuel Pepys described as a horrid, malicious, bloody flame engulfing the city, which made him weep to see it. And yet, at the end of the day, despite this terrible calamity, it's a story of hope and resilience, and it's about Londoners getting back on their feet and straight back to work, rebuilding their houses and businesses, and like a phoenix, within a few years, London rises again from the ashes. So what we're going to do now is we're going to cast our minds back to the year 1666, and let's just have a look at what the city would have looked like at that time. These would have been very narrow streets. It was a very filthy, dirty city. It was a very noisy city. You had to mind out because people would just indiscriminately throw the contents of their chamber pots out the window. And if you were lucky, they might shout out, "Gardez-loo!" If you didn't get out of the way, you'd end up with the contents on your head. There were lots of animals around. The streets were so narrow because these houses were called jetted, so they actually sort of jutted out at the top and you could shake hands across the street. That's how narrow they were. Now, the year before this, in 1665, there had been a terrible plague, the Great Plague. We lost about one in five Londoners in that outbreak and it had devastated the city. We were presently at war with the Dutch, and apparently, according to sources at the time, there was this feeling of expectation in the air. People felt like something was going to happen, but they weren't sure what. So it's the night of the 2nd of September 1666, and we go to Pudding Lane, and in Pudding Lane is a baker's, and the baker is called Thomas Farriner. Now, he isn't any normal kind of baker. He actually bakes ship's biscuits rather than the bread that you'd expect. He bakes ship's biscuits because he's got a commission from the Navy. And he thinks he's put the fire out. We're not sure if it's him or maybe it was his daughter, Hannah. But they think they put the fire out and everyone goes to bed. Now, at 1 o'clock in the morning, his servant, whose name is Teague, is woken up by the smell of smoke. And he comes down to the bakery, whereupon he finds the whole thing is engulfed in flames. So he rushes up, he alerts the family, and that includes Hannah, his daughter, and a maidservant. Now, sadly, we don't even know the maid's name, but they all try to escape. And Farriner, Teague, and Hannah manage to jump over the roofs. The maid, very young, probably absolutely terrified. She's too scared to jump. And sadly, she becomes the first victim of the fire. The fire starts to spread down Pudding Lane. And now, what we always have to remember is that fire isn't unusual in London. There's a lot of fire, but generally it's put out pretty quickly. But on this occasion, it's spreading quickly, and they decide to go and get the mayor, whose name is Thomas Bloodworth, and he's a bit of a baddie in our story. He comes down, he looks at the fire, and he says something rather rude, which I won't repeat here, and he goes off again. He says he doesn't think it's a problem, and off he goes. Now, serious mistake. Had he got on top of it at this point, got people to maybe start pulling down houses to create a break. Possibly the Great Fire of London would never have happened. However, he allows it to spread. And meanwhile, just a short distance away, in a road called Seething Lane, lives Samuel Pepys. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, his maid goes to him. She says, "Mr. Pepys," she said, "look out the window. There's this terrible fire." So he looks out of the window. But again, he doesn't think it's too bad. And he goes back to bed. Meanwhile, the fire spreads and it gets down to London Bridge and it starts to spread over the bridge. Now, thankfully, there was a natural break in the bridge. There had been a terrible fire a few decades earlier, and that is what saved the fire from getting over to the south of London. However, what it did do was it destroyed the water wheels under London Bridge, and that meant there was a shortage of water supply, which was not helpful. The fire is spreading down Fish Street Hill. It then spreads along Thames Street towards the west. Now, this is catastrophic because this is where the warehouses are. They are full of hemp, tar, oil, alcohol, and they just go up in flames. And there is a conflagration. At 7 o'clock in the morning, back at Samuel Pepys' house, he gets up, he looks out of the window, he still thinks it's not too bad, but Jane, his servant, says no, about 300 houses have burnt down. So he thinks, right, I'd better go and have a look. So he goes to the Tower of London. It's not looking great. He gets a boat out onto the river and it's horrific. And this is the point at which he says, this just makes me weep. He just saw this sort of great arc of fire and he knows something needs to be done. People are running about sort of like headless chickens. They don't know what to do. Nobody seems to be trying to put it out. They're just trying to save their belongings. People have rushed down to the river. They're trying to jump in boats. They're going from staircase to try and get away. But he thankfully has the presence of mind to get the boat up the river to go and see the king at Whitehall. And he gets to see him pretty quickly and he explains the situation. And he said, listen, we need to start pulling houses down to create breaks. So the king says, that's fine. Go back to London and order the mayor, Thomas Bludworth, to start pulling down the houses, which is duly what he does. So he's back in London. He finds Thomas Bludworth, but Thomas Bludworth is running around. He knows what he wants to do. He knows that houses need to be pulled down. But he's concerned about upsetting people. The people won't be happy. So he's not doing the right thing. And Pepys says, look, the king says you do have to pull these houses down. Meanwhile, Bludworth says, I've had enough. Apparently, he's described by Pepys as being like a fainting woman. And he washes his hands of it. And he says, I've got to go to bed. I haven't had any sleep. And off he goes. So he really doesn't come out well in this story. They were trying to put the fire out in various different ways. They used buckets, which were made of leather. They also had instruments called squirts, which couldn't hold a huge amount of water. They, believe it or not, they did have some rudimentary fire engines, not fire engines as we would know them of today, but they were very cumbersome, not very effective. And of course, they had fire hooks to pull down the houses. And a really good place to go if you want to see some of these things is the Museum of London. They have a very good exhibition on the Great Fire there. Now, moving on, the fire progresses. We're in day two now. The wind starts to change direction and it starts to go north. And this is going up to the sort of wealthy part of the city. And flakes of fire are starting to sort of spread over London and start fires independently. And what this does is it makes people think that people are setting fires out on purpose. And one of the worst bits about this story is that there was some terrible xenophobia at this time. Foreigners were being blamed for the fires. The French, the Dutch, anyone who didn't sound English was being blamed. And in the end, what the authorities were having to do was they were actually having to lock up foreigners for their own safety, because there were great gangs. There were gangs of women, there were gangs of men going round. And there's some very, very unpleasant stories indeed of what was happening to foreigners. Two surprising heroes of our story are the King, King Charles II, and his brother, the Duke of York. You might know Charles II. He's the chap with a big wig. He's known as the Merry Monarch. This is the Restoration period. The Restoration Court was a place of great merriment and debauchery, and they were having a good time. But when it came down to it, these two got on the case. They came to London and they were on the ground trying to get this fire out. They were, the Duke of York was creating command posts. They were giving people money as incentive to get this fire out. And they really do come out very well indeed. Pepys returns to his house and he knows his fire, his house is in danger. And he gathers all his things to take them off, and he decides that he must save some of his most precious belongings. So he digs a big hole in his garden and he buries his wine and his Parmesan cheese. And actually, he was very fortunate because the fire did stop just short of his house and he was able to go and retrieve these goods after the fire had died down. So the fire, it's now spreading. It's spreading down Cheapside, which was the marketplace, and it gets to St. Paul's. Now, nobody's that worried about St. Paul's. It's a stone building. Of course, it's huge. And they think, well, that's not going to burn. I'm going to put my precious goods in St. Paul's. And particularly the booksellers in the area, they get their books and they put them down in the crypt. Unfortunately, the cathedral, it was really in a bad way. And a few weeks before the fire broke out, the King had asked the great architect, who was very young at the time, Sir Christopher Wren, if he would do some restoration work on the cathedral. So Sir Christopher Wren put some wooden scaffolding all the way around the cathedral and started work. What happened, of course, when the fire got to the cathedral is that the wood went up in flames. The huge lead roof, this was a massive cathedral, there were 6 acres of lead roof. The lead roof melted down into the crypt where all these books had been put. And of course, the whole thing went up in flames and was absolutely engulfed. In fact, there's another great diarist of the time called John Evelyn, and he describes the conflagration at St. Paul's. He says the stones flew like grenades and melting lead ran down the street in streams. The fire was at its peak. You could see it 40 miles away in Oxford. The ground was so hot that you couldn't put your feet on it. Horses couldn't put their hooves down. And in fact, you know, it must have been terrible for the animals. There were lots of animals in London. And you hear stories of Samuel Pepys talks about the pigeons who couldn't find anywhere to perch and their wings would be singed by the fire and they would just fall out of the sky. And he also tells of a terrible story after the fire where someone goes back to their cellar and they retrieves the cat. They bring the cat out, terrified, alive, but all its fur had gone. The fire got so hot that it was 1,700 degrees Celsius, which I think is hard to imagine when you think our ovens only go up to about 250. So it really was just so hot. But thankfully, the winds now start to drop. They have realised that they need to use gunpowder and they start to blow up houses. And thankfully, they blow up a lot of houses near the Tower of London with this gunpowder. Thank goodness they did, because had they not done that, it would have got to the tower, and the tower was where they actually kept their stores of gunpowder, and it would have just exploded, and we wouldn't have the Tower of London now. So thankfully, it was saved, and the fire gradually goes out. Now, we are very thankful that only 6 people are recorded to have died in the Fire of London. Probably a lot more died, but of the 6 recorded, one of them was the maid. There was an old lady who was sheltering by the wall of St Paul's, and another young chap called William Taswell, he wrote a diary, and he came across her incinerated body. And there was a chap nearby in Shoe Lane called Paul Lowell, and he was a watchmaker. And his family desperately tried to get him to leave his house, but he was very, very old man, and he wouldn't leave. So he was another one of those 6. It mainly stayed within the city walls. The city walls at the time did help to contain the fire, but it did start going west. And actually, there was a time when I think the king was quite worried it might reach sort of Westminster and the Whitehall area. It did actually manage to jump the River Fleet, but around the sort of Temple area, if you know that, it died sort of there. Now, after the fire, everybody was blamed. The French were blamed, the Catholics were blamed. Even the sin of gluttony was blamed, because it started in Pudding Lane and it ended in Pie Corner. They were desperate for a scapegoat. And in the end, a poor chap called Robert Hubert, who was French, he came and he admitted it. He said, "I did it. I threw a sort of burning rocks into the bakery and it was me." And he went to trial. Everybody knew he quite clearly had mental health problems. He quite clearly hadn't done it. In fact, they later found out he wasn't even in the country at the time. He was on a ship waiting to dock. However, they needed a scapegoat, and the jurors found him guilty. And one interesting bit of the story is that one of the jurors was Thomas Farriner. And of course, it was certainly in Thomas Farriner's interest that someone else should be to blame. He definitely wanted to deflect the blame from himself. Interestingly, in 1986, the Worshipful Company of Bakers met in Pudding Lane and finally admitted that it wasn't anybody else. It was one of their own. It was a baker. It was about 320 years too late, but they did finally own up to it. And of course, what do they need to do now? They need to rebuild London. And this is this great hopeful part of our story, because Sir Christopher Wren and various other people submitted plans, and they were sort of plans to have these sort of beautiful boulevards and piazzas. However, it just wasn't practical. Everybody just wanted to move back where they had lived before. So they decided to rebuild London on its medieval street plan. And we still have that very distinctive street plan. You know, we've got all these sort of steel and glass that we have today, but we are still on our medieval street plan. Wren, however, did submit plans to rebuild the cathedral, and eventually these were accepted, and we have the most stunning building, our beautiful Baroque St Paul's Cathedral. And he also rebuilt 52 churches. Apparently, everyone behaved incredibly well after the fire. They had fire courts which were very fair. Robert Hooke was a great hero, this story, who went and he plotted everybody's houses exactly where they'd been before and made sure they had the right amount of land. And it was a very, very successful rebuilding of London. I just want to finish with a lovely story. When Sir Christopher Wren was looking to rebuild St Paul's, he turned up on day one and he wanted to mark the spot where the middle of the dome would be. So he sent someone off and they came back with a bit of tombstone, and on it, it said, "Resurgam, I will rise again." And this was seen as being a sign. And if today you cross Millennium Bridge and you look up at the south side of St Paul's, you look up and there in the pediment, the triangular bit at the top, there is a phoenix rising from its ashes with the word Resurgam underneath. London rising again. Thank you for listening.